The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in the new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jason Phipps, and when you hear my voice, usually it's followed by, I'm sorry to say, but Alec Jha and Ian Sample are away, and so it leaves it to me, the humble producer, to introduce you to what's on this week's show. In this edition, we have returned to an interview we featured a few weeks back. Ben Goldacre's book, Bad Pharma, is a forensic and searching look at how drug companies can mislead doctors and, by implication, harm patients. Alec Jha spoke at length to Ben Goldacre about his claims and why bad pharma is bad for us all.
Ben, thank you very much for coming back on the podcast after how many years?
8 million.
8 million years. That's a fact. That's a scientifically proven fact. So, Ben, tell us, how is a drug licensed in the UK?
Okay, so I think almost a more important question is, how do doctors and patients decide what drug to use to treat a medical problem? Because the bar to get on the market is actually very low. In a lot of cases, you only have to show that your drug is better than nothing, which is a very low bar. A lot of people think they know what a randomized control trial looks like. They think it's you do a comparison of a new drug against a dummy placebo sugar pill. But actually, that only answers a very boring abstract question of, is this treatment better than nothing? In reality, we want to know, is this treatment better than the best currently available treatment, the one that we're already using? We don't care if it's better than nothing. We want to know which drug is best. So the problem arises at the very beginning of the approval process, in that regulators will very commonly allow drugs onto the market with only evidence showing that they're better than placebo. A third of all of the drugs that came onto the market through the FDA, for example, from 2000 to 2010, were only shown to be better than placebo, even though there was an effective treatment on the market already. So there's a very, very low bar. So drugs will be trialled in maybe a couple of trials of several hundred patients, maybe a couple of thousand patients' worth of data in total. Often they'll come onto market also only with trials looking at something called surrogate outcomes. So they're kind of theoretical outcomes. You'll look at a change in blood pressure or a change in a reading in a blood test rather than a real world outcome like disability or suffering or death. And that's, again, partly a function of the need for companies to get their drug onto the market as quickly as possible while they still own the patent. So they need things that will change very quickly. And so it's very easy to show that your drug changes blood pressure levels or changes cholesterol levels. But one of the problems with medical research, of course, is that people take a long time to die. So you have to wait a long time if you're going to do a long-term trial that follows up to see whether your drug, which is ultimately supposed to prevent death, for example, does actually prevent death. So drugs are very commonly licensed with poor quality trials in the sense that they make irrelevant comparisons. They compare a new drug against a dummy placebo sugar pill. They look at surrogate outcomes, which aren't informative for everyday use. But then finally, there's a third problem, which is you can show that a drug is effective in maybe 2,000 or 3,000 patients, but you can't necessarily detect side effects. Because if there's a side effect that happens in only 1 in 1,000 patients, but which is very important, then it's quite possible that you'll completely miss it in your trial follow-up data that only lasts for 6 months and only covers a couple of thousand people. So that's why when you're taught how to prescribe at medical school, you're often told, don't prescribe new drugs. Unless they're really fantastic, then, you know, let other people take the chances. Regard the whole of the rest of humanity as unpaid stunt doubles, because you're often comparing something which has only been shown to be effective on a surrogate outcome in 3,000 people for 6 months, and you're comparing that against a treatment which, you know, might be a little bit less effective, but we know that tens of millions of people have taken it safely, and we know that it has a real-world benefit.
Now, emotionally speaking, brand-new drugs always imply to people who maybe aren't are wise to these things something cutting-edge, amazing, it's going to make everything better. And this is something you're saying that, you know, doctors are trained not to pay attention to.
Well, we hope, but in reality, we know that doctors very commonly do prescribe whiz-bang new drugs. And that's partly because, of course, doctors and patients fetishize the new. And also, new drugs are very aggressively marketed by drug companies. And there's a really important context for this. There's a fantastic systematic review that's it's either just come out or it's about to come out. I've got an advanced copy by Benjul Begovic. And it looks at the very simple question, when a new drug comes out and it's compared against the old drug, what are the odds, just completely a priori, for all new drugs against all old drugs, what are the odds that the new drug will be better? And it's just above even. So, you know, that's not evidence that you would use to inform every single prescribing decision, of course, but I think it's incredibly relevant background information for the extent to which we fetishize new drugs and the extent to which we're wrong to.
So ideally speaking, a drug goes through several phases of clinical trials, the data is reported to regulators, the drug is allowed, and then doctors get information about the effects of these things and prescribe them, you know, in an informed fashion. Now, your book wouldn't be your book if you didn't sort of imply that that wasn't quite happening.
I prove that
in your own way. Let's take a drug, say like Tamiflu, and tell me what happened to that drug and how that idealized structure that I talked about wasn't applied.
Okay, well, with Tamiflu, this is a drug which governments around the world have spent billions of dollars on stockpiling in the belief that it will reduce the likelihood of people having complications after having influenza. And complications, of course, is a medical euphemism, meaning pneumonia and death. Now, the evidence on whether it does that or not is still being withheld to this day from the Cochrane Acute Respiratory Infections Group. We know that, just very briefly, Cochrane is an international non-profit collaboration of academics who produce gold standard systematic reviews and summaries of all of the evidence on a given medical question. And we know that publication bias is a huge problem. We know that negative trials go missing in action. We know overall that only about half of the trials that are ever conducted ever get published. We know that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published as trials with negative results.
And that's why you do systematic reviews, which is to take lots of trials and pool the data together.
Well, no, because when you do systematic reviews, that's when you're hindered by this, because that's when you're summarising a biased sample because you're seeing positive results, but you're deprived of negative results. So knowing that this is a problem, Cochrane, of course, has now begun going to drug companies and going to regulators and saying, we have concerns that there may be some trials that are not adequately published. We have concerns that there are trials which have been published only in very brief summary form, but we need more information to know if they were methodologically appropriate, because, of course, not every trial is necessarily a fair test. There can be flaws in the design of a trial, which means that it is biased or vulnerable to bias, and so more likely to give a positive result for the drug. But also we know that some trials can go completely missing in action, completely AWOL. So the Cochrane Acute Respiratory Infections Group got in touch with the drug company and said, we would like to have all of the clinical study reports, which are the long form of the results and the methods for all of the trials that you've conducted on Tamiflu. And what they have discovered is an absolutely staggering mess, and a mess which we've every reason to believe generalizes to a great many drugs, if not potentially all drugs that have ever come onto the market. So firstly, it's very clear that completely different sets of trials were reported to different regulatory authorities. The company themselves don't seem to be able to give a consistent account of what trials have been conducted. So when you ask one office, they say one thing. When you ask another office, they say another thing. But also, as I show in the book in great detail, citing peer-reviewed academic journal articles describing this monstrous disaster, really, the company is still withholding this information from Cochrane and giving the most extraordinary reasons for doing so. I mean, they sort of say, oh, well, we don't like the look of you. We don't want you to be able to have our information to analyse.
What about regulators? Surely regulators can require this information.
Well, so that's a very, very interesting issue. The immediate comeback that you get in a 90-second discussion on this issue from the pharmaceutical industry, for example, is, oh, we are one of the most tightly regulated industries in the world. We have to give all of the information to regulators. And that sounds superficially plausible. The problem is, firstly, we know, and there are many, many stories on this in the book, that people don't always report all the trial data to regulators. But secondly, we know that trial regulators withhold the information that they do have from doctors and patients. So the European Medicines Agency, for example, in one particularly scandalous story described in the book, spent 3.5 years refusing to hand over to the Nordic Cochrane Group the clinical study reports on two widely used anti-obesity drugs, Orlistat and Rimonabant. And this was the subject of a 3.5-year-long battle involving the European Ombudsman, who made a finding of maladministration against the European Medicines Agency. And during this episode, the European Medicines Agency raised the most bizarre and extraordinary objections to sharing this information with Cochrane and therefore doctors and patients. And you have to remember, you know, doctors and patients need all of the evidence about the results of clinical trials in order to make informed decisions about whether a treatment is appropriate for them, whether it's safe and effective. The European Medicines Agency very simply took industry's side. They said that the results of these studies are contain commercially sensitive data, which is clearly untrue. I mean, and even if it was true, it would have to be considered proportionately alongside the needs of patients. Secondly, they said that the clinical study reports contained identifiable patient data, and this is something that they raised 2 years into the battle after they had already tried and failed to convince the European Ombudsman that this information was commercially sensitive. And the European Ombudsman finally got hold of the full reports and said, well, that's ridiculous. You know, obviously, it's very easy to strip out this information. It's a trivial thing to do. So this is a 3.5-year-long battle of the European regulator, who now cover drugs in the UK. They are the people who approve drugs to the market for use in this country. 3.5 years, they battled to deliberately withhold information about the safety and effectiveness of medicines from doctors and patients. Now, that
in all that time, the drug was available.
Well, in all that time, the drug was available. And fascinatingly, the European Medicines Agency said to Cochrane, well, it's for you to prove that we are putting patients at risk by withholding this information. And then staggeringly, 3 years into this battle, one of these two drugs was taken off the market because it did more harm than good. It increased the risk of suicide and death. Now, that's an extraordinary, extraordinary episode. And it amazes me that this isn't front page news. And I think the reason why it isn't is it's to an extent protected by a force field of scientific complexity, if you like. I mean, it takes about 5 minutes to get to the point where people understand why it's a problem. And a 5-minute pitch to explain why large numbers of people are suffering and dying unnecessarily, unfortunately, turns out to be, excessive for our, you know, our current means of raising public awareness of serious and important problems like this. But this is a flaw at the absolute core of the information architecture of the whole of evidence-based medicine. And it's a peculiar, I mean, what I describe in the book is a complex interlocking ecosystem of problems that all reinforce each other, and of which this is only one. And in every single case, there are people who I suspect probably aren't necessarily evil people. I mean, I doubt that anybody who works in a drug company or the European Medicines Agency, you know, I doubt that they could punch an old lady in the face or drown a baby. But when you distort or participate in the distortion of the clinical evidence that doctors and patients use to make decisions, that has a real-world impact. People suffer and die unnecessarily as a result of those actions. And I genuinely believe that this is, I think it will turn out to be like MPs' expenses or like phone-tapping journalists. When you're working inside these communities, people reinforce each other's view that what they're doing is okay. And it's only when people from outside come in and realise what's been going on that suddenly it all explodes in your face. And I think the European Medicines Agency should be very worried and anxious at the prospect of the general public realising what they've done.
Well, in the case of a phone-tapping journalist, that was actually illegal. There was no question that was an okay thing to do. But can I ask you, though, about the trial...
The staggering thing about everything that I describe in the book is that, for the most part, it is all completely legal.
Well, this is where I'm going to come to you about the trials, then. So just explain to me, if you can, briefly, what it is that, despite the fact that no one is necessarily evil in these places or does anything cognitively thinking, well, I'm going to go and kill lots of people, what it is that can go wrong in a trial or can be tweaked in a way that makes the results, you know, useless.
Okay, so it's important to remember, firstly, you know, I am a clinical trials methodology dork. I think this stuff is absolutely fascinating, just from a kind of pop science nerd perspective. It's also important to remember that flaws in clinical trials generalize throughout the whole world of clinical trials. So, you know, academic-run trials can be flawed just the same as industry-run trials can be. And I mean, I think to an extent, academics are kind of a sideshow in this because the vast overwhelming majority of clinical trials are conducted by the pharmaceutical industry. But nonetheless, that's important to remember. Secondly, it's also important to remember that drug trials aren't only conducted before a drug comes to market in order to get it on the market. There's also a huge amount of clinical trials research that goes on after a drug comes to market. Often not enough, as I explain in the book. Often people get onto the market with very, very poor quality evidence, promising that they will do good quality real-world trials once the drug is on the market, and then fail to do so, and nobody chases them up for it. In fact, we know that about one in three of the commitments to make clinical trials, to conduct meaningful post-marketing clinical trials in the US were never met. But in any case, many of the trials that are done after a drug comes to market. So a trial can be flawed by design in a whole host of interesting ways. We've already discussed a couple, actually. So you can compare your new drug against something that's not very good, like a placebo, or sometimes in some particularly horrific episodes, people compare their treatment against an inappropriately high dose of the comparator treatment so that people have worse side effects, or an inappropriately low dose of the comparator treatment so that people don't get adequate benefit from it. But then you move on to more interesting problems. Like, for example, you can switch your primary outcome between the beginning of a trial and the end of a trial. Now, that's a real problem because if you think about that game that they play, you have on the sort of seafront sometimes where there are three cups and they wiggle it around and the ball's under one of those cups. The gamble that you make on trying to find the ball, that assumes that you're only going to look under one cup. If you allow yourself to look under more than one cup, then you've got an increased chance of finding the ball. Now, it's exactly the same with the statistical tests that we use to see if a finding in a clinical trial was statistically significant. They assume that you're only doing one test. You're only checking to see if there was a statistically significant benefit on one outcome. The problem is, when you're running a clinical trial, you can measure maybe 20 or 30 different things. So if you're doing a trial of an antidepressant, for example, you might measure the Hamilton Anxiety and Depression Scale and three subscales on that. You might do the Beck Depression Inventory. You might do an Activities of Daily Living score, a Quality of Life Assessment, a Barrett Impulsivity Scale, any number of other things. So if you measure, say, 20 things in total as possible outcomes in your study, then if your cutoff for statistical significance is p equals 0.05, it's very likely that one of those will turn out to have improved over the course of your trial, even if the drug does absolutely nothing at all, simply through the play of chance, simply from what you would expect from the natural random variation in the data. Because, of course, you know, just from the foibles of everyday life, people's mood or anxiety will go up or down over time. So switching outcomes is a huge, huge problem in medicine. And the thing that was supposed to stop it is you're supposed to register your protocol before you begin, and then everybody can see what you're planning to do. And actually, hopefully, they can also see if you bury the results altogether. And then at the end of your trial, people can look and go, okay, did you report as your primary outcome in your published academic journal article on your trial? Did you report your primary outcome in there? Was it the same as the primary outcome that you specified before you began? Or have you done a bait and switch?
And people do this regularly?
Oh, incredibly common. I mean, unbelievably commonly. And there are endless papers cited in the book where people have just...
But this would have been documented, right? And so why, again, regulators, where do they come in?
Well, okay, so remember, you know, regulators only play that kind of very strong role. Firstly, in the early phases of a trial, but they in the early phases of a drug's development, but they have no input into what appears in an academic journal article, which is what doctors and patients use to make decisions. And so here you see another example of this sort of complex ecosystem of failures that all reinforce each other. And the way that we have left policing this incredibly important stuff in the hands of amateurs who have proven themselves to be incompetent. So academic journals should, by rights, when you go through an extensive peer review process, it should be completely routine that you get the protocol and you look and see, is the primary outcome specified in the protocol the same as the primary outcome specified in this published in this paper that we're being invited to publish? And journals very commonly simply do not do that. And it's preposterous. It's ludicrous. It's particularly preposterous when you think about the enormous ball ache and fuss of getting an academic journal article published, which I'm sure many people listening to this podcast will be very familiar with. There is often an endless to and fro about, finicky things about what you say in the discussion section at the end, which frankly, to my mind, is usually not even worth reading. It's like the comment pages in a newspaper. But with the greatest respect to people who write articles.
Isn't that where your column appeared?
No, it isn't actually.
I think you'll find.
So journals, while they make a huge fuss about whether you've formatted your references correctly, or they make a huge fuss about, whether you've cited the peer reviewer's own papers because he wants the citation points on Web of Science, somehow they fail to police this incredibly basic and vitally important statistical issue. Have people appropriately reported the primary outcome in this paper that was the primary outcome in the protocol?
But isn't the more important thing, which you've raised in articles and books already, all these little quirks that can come along, these methodological problems, they're one thing. Yep. The bigger elephant in the room is the fact that you can do lots of trials and only publish the one that favours your particular drug.
Absolutely. And it's staggering and appalling and ludicrous, not only that it has happened for so many decades, but more than that, that we have failed to fix it. And finally, I think the greater scandal now, and the area where people really should be held to personal account, is that people now pretend that this problem has been fixed when it very, very, very demonstrably has not. So the problem is, as you say, you can do a whole bunch of trials on your drug, and if those trials have positive results, you can publish them. If it has negative results, you can bury them. And this has enormous implications for treatment decisions. In fact, overall, it means, we simply cannot know the true effects of the treatments that we use as doctors and patients. Now, it's important to be clear here. Overall, I think that all of these tricks add up to not necessarily a situation where the treatments that we give do more harm than good, although that does happen occasionally. What they add up to more, I think, is a situation where, for example, you will prescribe a new expensive drug where an older, cheaper drug is actually more effective because you have been misled by publication bias, negative trials going missing in action, by badly designed trials, by marketing, which distorts the evidence that we already have, and also finally by a failure of vision on the part of doctors and academics and funders and society, really, to do adequate comparative studies comparing the best currently available options that are on the market. So as I said, half of all the clinical trials that are conducted are never published, the ones with positive results twice as likely to be published. And that's why, or one of the reasons why, industry-funded trials are four times more likely to report a positive result. Now, every single thing that people have claimed has fixed this problem of negative trials going missing in action has failed. And they have failed in plain sight, and for anybody to claim or pretend that these things have been fixed is, in my view, dishonest and unethical.
Well, we'll come to some fixes a bit later, perhaps. Let's talk about the other side of this. Clinical trials and trying to work out what individual drugs are doing to populations is incredibly complex. There are thousands of variables. And I suppose the problem you're outlining is that it's very easy to see whatever you need and want to see from data sets. And you can then do trials in a bad way that means that you get the results you want. But my question is this. Isn't this kind of inevitable when you have a market-driven drug industry? These people are spending billions and billions of pounds looking for individual compounds that can solve obesity or whatever else. And they need to make that money back. So it's not in their interest, really, to find bad results or publicize them.
That's right, and that's exactly why we need competent regulation that forces people to publish the results of all clinical trials. And you know, that should be entirely obvious. I'm a complete realist. I mean, I don't want a Stalinist central command state economy, although it'd be nice if, you know, all mobile phones and laptops had the same charger connector. There's no doubt at all that the pharmaceutical industry have produced many, many fantastic drugs. In many respects, I think that they simply behave in a rational way, exactly how you would expect people to behave if you put them in an incompetent regulatory framework where you can count on regulators not to force you to publish results and not to hand over even the results which they have to doctors and patients. So I think, I think that it's hard to regard much of the behaviour that I describe in the book as actively stylish, but I think it's also, to an extent, as you say, it's inevitable. And that's why we need competent regulation, but it's also why we need, I think, professions and people who are supposed to have patients' interests at heart to step up and take some responsibility for understanding the problem and attempting to fix it. I mean, I find it absolutely remarkable, for example, that no single medical membership body, none of the Royal Colleges, not the BMA, not the GMC, none of them have stood up and said non-publication of clinical trial results is research misconduct. It breaches our code of conduct, and if you do it as a doctor, then you will be punished. And I think that is extraordinary.
Why have they not done that? Is it something that's not important to them?
I suppose they don't care. I suppose, as I said earlier, because it takes 5 minutes to explain why it's a problem, there's nothing motivating them to do it because there are no public calls for it. I mean, you know, I don't know. How do you make people do the right thing? I suppose, you know, shame, violence and love are probably the three motivators you have. And shame, I think, is the only option, which is why it's very interesting to me that so many of these groups have been unhappy and angry that I have taken all of these problems, which are very, very well known within the professions and very, very well documented within the academic medical literature, and shared them with a wider audience, because that really is all I've done. I mean, there's nothing melodramatically new in this book in the sense that it's all been hiding in plain sight. It's all published in academic journals. But I think, you know, we need to take these things to a wider audience to provoke the professions into doing the right thing. I honestly believe, speaking as a doctor, that if we do not lead from the front on fixing these problems as medics, then we will be judged very, very harshly by patients. But it goes well beyond that. It amazes me that patient groups who are supposed to have their members' best interests at heart do not hold companies to account. It amazes me that when they're criticising NICE and using all kinds of ghoulish language about things that they don't like NICE doing, like rejecting very expensive drugs.
Just explain what NICE is.
NICE is National Institute for Clinical Excellence. It's a body that assesses the evidence on effectiveness and cost effectiveness of treatments to try and give guidance to doctors and commissioners of health services about whether or not you should use a treatment. And sometimes they turn treatments down in the sense that they recommend against them. And patient associations often get very, very angry at them. And I can understand that. But you never see a patient association saying to a drug company, firstly, why don't you lower the price of your drug? And secondly, why have you provided such weak, inconsequential evidence to NICE that it's impossible for them to make any kind of sensible decision about whether this treatment should be used in the way that you want it to be used? But lastly, I think the Diabetes Association, off the top of my head, I mean, they're probably called the Diabetes Society, but, you know, I think that all of these patient associations should be sitting on the trials registers, should be getting word from all of their members about trials that they've participated in which may not have been registered on clinical trials registers, and I think they should be going to all of the companies and saying, we have found through our monitoring activity that this trial finished more than 1 year ago, and you have not published the results. The members of our patient association need the results of that clinical trial in order to make informed decisions about whether their treatment is going to be safe and effective. Please hand over this trial result now. Why have you not done so? I think the patient associations, who are very highly motivated, they often have, you know, lots of members who can be their ears on the ground about trials that have been going on. I think they should be monitoring this stuff and they should be holding companies to account. So this is a failure across the board. Regulators and really the story of the European Medicines Agency, you know, if you read only one thing, just go into a bookshop. I'll find the page right now. Just go in and read that, right? Because it is absolutely
the patient group thing. Let me just ask you one thing on that. There is a conflict of interest with patient groups, isn't there? Because they
Page 70.
Just
go and read page 70.
Go and read page 70. We'll put it on the website or something. So the thing with the patient groups, there is a conflict of interest, surely, because they, as well as being campaigning for drugs and new drugs, they want to offer their members hope. They want to give people who've got particular diseases, and that's all those people care about, the next option for something. And so, in a sense, asking for too much data gives you answers you might not want.
I think that's a bit fanciful, to be honest.
I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm saying that's perhaps the part of the thinking.
So you think patient associations are conspiring with...
No, it's another one.
Reinforcing a fantasy that drugs are effective.
It's another case of of neglect, perhaps, rather than willful blindness.
Maybe. I mean, I can tell you one other reason why, in general, they may not be entirely inclined to hold companies to account, and that is
they're funded by them.
They're funded by them. So okay. Overall,
that's a better reason.
On average, the latest Health Action International survey of the patient groups who were lobbying at the European Medicines Agency, I think it was something like, in two different studies, two-thirds of them took money from drug companies, and on average it was about half of their running costs. I don't think that just because you've taken money you're necessarily going to change your view. I think it's more interesting than that. I think probably patient associations who naturally already favour industry's views, perhaps by happy coincidence, are more likely to get money. And they're more likely to survive and succeed as organisations than people who are just holding out collection boxes at village fetes. And so they didn't necessarily have to change their views in order to seduce industry. But if you look at the internal industry literature, which I've got a couple of quotes in the book, it's very obvious, and of course it is, the way they talk about companies sponsoring these patient groups is in promotional terms. And it's also interesting to look and see how they vote, because another study looking at voting patterns in the patient representative panels at the European Medicines Agency showed that patient groups who receive industry funding are much more likely to vote in favour of industry on questions like, should the industry be allowed to directly communicate with patients about the benefits of medicines?
You mean TV adverts, for example?
Well, maybe not as far as TV adverts, but, slippery slope and all of that.
Yeah.
Patient associations take the money, fine. They declare it very inconsistently. The ones that do declare it very rarely say how much they got from each individual drug company. And they'd never say, we got this much money from this company who make this drug, which you probably use. And at the same time, if you read their annual reports, they say very clearly, Mr. Perkins of 3 Sunhill Grove got £371, 26p for doing a sponsored run. If they can give that level of detail about Mr. Perkins of Sunhill Grove, I think they can give the same level of detail about which drug company gave them how much money.
Now, just one more thing before we go on to how to make everything better. In your book, there's a line that's quite striking. You said that the public's been failed by people at the top of medicine on matters of life and death, as well as people in pharmaceutical companies and all sorts of other things, people who should be looking out for them, essentially. But on the other side of that, lifespan is up. We're generally healthier than 50 years ago. Life's better. Evidence-based medicine is a very dominant paradigm. How big a problem is what you're talking about? Are you being melodramatic?
No. I mean, when half of all clinical trials results disappear and positive results are twice as likely to be published as negative results, the end product of that is we simply do not know the real effects of the treatments that we prescribe. Now, I think, and you're absolutely right to say life expectancy's up and we've got lots of great new treatments, I think all of this stuff has felt morally defensible to people because the end product is, as I said earlier, the treatments that we give, they are effective, but because the evidence is distorted, we don't give the best treatment. Now, I think if you give a drug which is only half as good as a drug which you could give at the same price, then you have inflicted avoidable suffering and harm and death, potentially, on somebody. And I think that is as great an insult as withholding treatment entirely. There's a complete moral equivalence there. So I think it's fascinating that these issues have felt, I think, morally defensible to people because they've known that what they're doing at least is better than nothing. But better than nothing isn't good enough. And actually, you know, it goes without saying that all of the stuff about drug companies hiding data, researchers hiding data, regulators withholding data, that's all, to my mind, plainly unethical and very, very simply avoidable. But I think there's also a second problem, which I also talk about in the book, which is a kind of failure of ambition on the part of evidence-based medicine, on the part of doctors and patients and politicians. Because in the NHS, for example, we have in our electronic health records a resource that could be harnessed at very low cost to compare the relative benefits of treatments in widespread use and optimise care on a daily basis. We could minimise harm and we could maximise benefits and turn the NHS into this enormous testing and learning machine that would produce valuable information that could save lives, not just in the UK, but by producing results that are relevant to everybody everywhere in the world. So, for example, I'm involved in a trial that's running as part of GPRD, the General Practice Research Database, just been renamed to CPRD, actually. And the idea of this trial is very straightforward. We know that the trials that get done are often too small. We know also that trials are often done in unrepresentative patients, in ideal patients. We know that trials are very expensive, and so they don't run for very long, because they run as standalone administrative projects. So our project is very simple. There are two statins currently in widespread use in the UK, atorvastatin and simvastatin. Nobody knows which is best. So we know that they're both roughly the same at reducing your cholesterol levels, and we know that they've both been compared against nothing to see if they're better at saving lives, and they both are. We know that they're both safe and effective because we know that they've both been used by millions, if not tens of millions of people around the world for many, many years with no problems or no great problems. The benefits hugely outweigh the risks. But nobody's ever compared the two in a head-to-head test. And if it turned out that one or other was only 1 or 2% better, then because heart attack is so common, because raised cholesterol is so common, because there are so many people on statins, this would represent an enormous money and life-saving exercise.
You can do that if you've got data from people taking this across the country.
Okay, so what you don't want to do is just rely on collecting electronic health records from people who are already being prescribed these treatments. Because the problem there is you can never be sure that the people on one drug or another drug are perfectly comparable. It may turn out, for example, that posher, healthier people for some reason get put on one drug rather than another. It may turn out that some patients with certain medical problems which predispose them to having a shorter life expectancy get put on the drug which has some kind of mythical a priori sort of mythos around it that it's safer. So paradoxically, the safer drug might appear to be less effective. So you can't rely on that. What you need to do is randomize. And so the objective of our project is to see how seamlessly could you embed a randomized controlled trial comparing these two statins that are already in widespread use, already known to be safe and effective. How seamlessly could you embed a trial like that in routine clinical practice? So the ideal is you go along to your GP. He says, well, I think you need a statin. This is just a normal practice. And then when he goes and tries to prescribe a statin, a big red screen comes up and it says, wait, we don't know whether atorvastatin or simvastatin is the best. Press this big red button here to randomly assign your patient to one or the other, and you'll never have to think about it ever again. And never having to think about it ever again is really crucial here, because the thing that makes trials expensive is you have to get people back in for extra follow-up, do some special cholesterol, you have to track them down, see if they've had a heart attack, measure their heart performance or whatever. But with electronic health records, we can suck all of that follow-up data out of routinely collected administrative records that are there anyway. So you get it for free and forever, for the whole of the rest of their lives. You can see if they have a heart attack. You can see if they die from ONS data. You can see what their cholesterol is opportunistically. Now, it's not blinded, and research is always about trading off strengths and weaknesses on practical and ethical issues. But actually, I don't believe that that's a major issue here, because I don't believe that patients necessarily have very strong beliefs that simvastatin or atorvastatin is best. But that is one small flaw. Now, this trial can run for about £500,000, which compares to $120 million for the All Hat trial, which is a reasonably comparable project from America. So it can run for almost nothing. And more importantly, it's just one example of the kinds of trials that we could be doing routinely throughout the NHS. I mean, you know, to my mind, whenever there is uncertainty about which of two treatments is the best, I think that doctors and patients should routinely expect that they would randomise, and then we would find out as quickly as we possibly could which treatment was best.
Now, this is some of the promise of legislation that's being sort of discussed at the moment around sharing of NHS data, right? And coming in the next few years, hopefully the idea is that maybe, well, at least the Conservative government, the coalition government rather, does want more sharing of NHS data, sort of anonymised data which can be used for better health outcomes. I mean, this is a thing that I know you're supportive of.
Well, yeah, it kind of. So, I mean, well, I'm certainly a supporter of it. It's a slightly different project in the sense that the government is hoping to sell that information to companies, which I have to say I think is reasonable. You know, the NHS incurs costs in collecting that information, but also I think it's reasonable to view it as a resource that can be sold to extract its value. As long as that is done very, very cautiously with respect to the anonymity.
My point is,
patients.
It can tell you things fairly quickly about some intervention of some sort, whether it's a pharmaceutical or whether you stop smoking or
that's
all
right.
These sorts of lifestyle
as long as it's randomised, as long as you're embedding randomised trials in there. So as I said, if you're only using it for observational research, that's also fine and good. But that's not completely ideal. So I think they're trying to run randomised trials within it, and they're also selling it for observational research. Now, actually, GPRD, which is the predecessor to this system, has been around for many, many years. In fact, it was run as a private concern until it was bought, or rather licensed, I think, by the MHRA. So this is not new. You know, we've been selling electronic health records in the UK to companies to help them identify side effects in routinely collected electronic health record data on the use of their drugs.
The MHRA being the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Authority, which is the thing that actually gives a drug its license.
It used to be, yeah. But now it's the European Medicines Agency.
Well, let's go back to the sort of central message of your book. And the sort of the more positive ends of this, well, if you can say the beginnings of the positive ends. You've got a whole list of paragraphs for different audiences, for what they can do next. Do you want to take me through what you think the most important bits of that are in terms of doctors, patients, and even you've got advice for pharmaceutical company workers? What do doctors and patients, first of all, need to be doing?
Well, a lot of this I've covered already, I suppose. I mean, firstly, I think every doctor who hears this should get onto their professional membership body and say to them, I think in our code of conduct, we should include a statement saying that not publishing clinical trial results is research misconduct. I think that's a really important basic place to start. And I think every doctor and every academic should write to their professional membership body, should table a motion to that effect at their next annual meeting and make sure that that gets onto their organisation's statutes, because, you know, publication bias really is the cancer at the core of evidence-based medicine. It makes a mockery of everything that we do. We try to reduce the bias in clinical trials as much as we possibly can at all times, and then after all of that effort, I mean, why do we even do randomised trials in the first place to get unbiased results if we're then going to allow all of that bias to creep back in?
Have you done this for your medical organisation?
Yeah, well, that's a really, really good question, isn't it? So I was thinking that as I as I wrote the end of the book just about 6 weeks ago. And you're right, I haven't, and I'm going to. I mean, to be fair...
Which one is yours?
To be fair, I'm not a committee man.
Go on. What's which one's yours?
So for me, it would be British Medical Association. I'm a member of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, although I don't practice.
Okay, so those two groups need to start waiting for a letter.
They can expect a stern letter.
Go on then. Patients. What do patients need to do?
I think patients could possibly invite their doctors to post up in their waiting room a little polite notice saying whether they see drug company sales representatives, whether they accept drug company-sponsored education. And I think that would be a useful and interesting thing. I actually don't think that the marketing side of things is the most important part of the story of how evidence-based practice is distorted, but I think it's a real issue. But I certainly don't think that patients should drive a wedge in their relationship with their doctor. I mean, I think that's sort of by the by, really. I think
there is that danger, of course, of if you arm this is going to sound ridiculous when I say it, so I'm aware of that. If you arm them with too much information, then the doctors will spend 95% of their time sort of saying, "Hang on a minute." They're just arguing with their patients about what to do for treatment when there should be sort of a more joint consensus.
Well, so actually, I mean, something else that I talk about a lot in the book, which isn't just drug companies are assholes, rah, 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 and it's not even just doctors and academics and patient groups are dreadful. You know, there's a lot in there about the things that we need to do to sort of raise our ambitions in evidence-based medicine. And one of the most important parts of that, I think, is to get better at disseminating clinical evidence to the people who use it and need it in better forms. And actually, you know, if you put me in charge of medical research funding for the next year, I would cancel all primary research. I would cancel all clinical trials. And I would spend all of the money exclusively on better mechanisms for disseminating the evidence that we already have to doctors and patients, and better mechanisms for ensuring that evidence is implemented in the best possible way.
Your pitch to David Willetts?
Well, you know, amongst other things, I have discussed this with him actually just last week. I think it's really, really, really important. You know, for the cost of just one trial, you could move that project forwards in leaps and bounds. And there's really fascinating and very, very important work being done in, for example, the shared decision-making literature, as it's called. And it's best done, I think, in areas like oncology, where sometimes you see clinicians who will sit down and talk through survival curves with patients. They'll say, you know, you've had this lump removed. This, from patients like you in the past, this is your survival curve if you have this treatment. This is your survival curve if you have chemo plus tamoxifen. This is your survival curve if you just have tamoxifen. These are the possible side effects. Let's talk through in a very concrete way with this information whether or not you'd like to choose any one of these treatments. And actually, I think that the future for medicine, really, as we have increasingly rich information but an increasingly wide range of treatments, the future for medicine really is in doctors being kind of personal shoppers but also the interface between their patient's instantiation of a medical problem and this vast edifice of information about how best to treat it. I mean, I think in some respects doctors of the future are going to have to be very good at finding information and very good at communicating information with patients. So I think all of that stuff is a really important and exciting future, and I wish it got more attention.
I mean, that sounds like a wonderful ideal, but the thing is, that's going to be a very tough job for a GP. He has to be across so much.
Well, you say that. I mean, I'm actually staggered. I mean, firstly, you have to remember not all patients want to be involved in that, and I think that's absolutely fine. You know, in the same way, I think that rich data should be available about the performance of different schools in an area, but we also know that only about a fifth of parents ever look at that stuff. That's fine. I don't think people have to do it, but I think it should be available. Now, if you consider this from the perspective of a patient, actually, isn't it extraordinary that you can't go into a doctor's surgery and pick up a leaflet that says, this is how we find out whether treatments work or not, this is how we monitor the side effects of drugs after they come on the market? Isn't that extraordinary? Isn't it extraordinary that Cochrane, who produce all of these fantastic summaries of all of the literature, which are very, very technical, isn't it extraordinary that they don't have a patient-facing website? Because every single Cochrane review has a lay summary in it, 400 words, could be understood by anyone. But it's buried in the middle of these huge, ludicrously complicated documents that, you know, I struggle to get through. I, you know, there are so many simple things that could be done that don't necessarily require a doctor sitting down with a patient. There are so many things we could do to make it easier for patients to have access to specific information about their medical problem and possible treatments, but also access to the basic information about how do you know if a treatment is good or bad? How do we find out? Now, you know, I think evidence-based medicine, basic epidemiology, should be taught in schools. I think it should be core curriculum. I think we have this sort of bizarre 19th century science curriculum in schools. And if you look at what science stories get covered in newspapers, about half of it is medical stuff. So that's obviously what people are interested in. It's obviously what people need to know to make informed decisions. But it's also really important. It's really interesting. Systematic reviews and meta-analysis, which I teach to children in schools aged 14, doing bead experiments and demonstrating sampling error, right? That stuff is really important, really interesting, really valuable. So I don't think it's just necessarily about doctors and patients sitting down and having a long and involved conversation about numbers and statistics. I think we also need to up our game and raise our ambitions about involving patients better in treatment decisions and sharing with them information through the internet, through structured systems. And we also need to be better at getting information to doctors.
Pharmaceutical companies, what's your two sentences for them?
Well, so firstly, as I say about 1,000 times in the book, but people will never hear it, I don't think that people who work in drug companies are evil and bad, nor regulators. I mean, you know, I work in epidemiology now, medical stats, basically. And so, of course, lots of my friends go off and work for industry. Lots of my friends work for regulators. And that's, you know, they're fine, good people. And actually, it's often quite difficult to notice when you're in a perversely designed system that you're a cog in a wheel where, despite being a good person yourself, you're participating in a wider project that does actually result in avoidable harm. I would strongly encourage people within regulators to blow that whistle. Wherever you see something that looks dodgy, I think, you know, my email address is ban@badscience.net or alok.jar@guardian.co.uk. You know, anybody who works in a regulator or a drug company is aware of funny stuff going on. Even if it's trivial everyday stuff, even if it's the kind of banal everyday story of, oh, I was sat down and basically told today, mine through this data, dredge it for as long as you need to until you find something that makes our drug look good. Even if it's just banal everyday stories like that, I want to hear them or write an anonymous blog about them. You know, just make sure that people are sort of more aware of the realities, I suppose. Campaign harder within your organisation, although obviously this is very, very difficult for better transparency. But I think that's basically a red herring. I think really, especially for senior people in these organisations, you know, you don't benefit from competing against each other in a cack-handedly regulated system. Drug companies themselves should be demanding that there is competent international legislation requiring them to do the right thing. Because otherwise they're competing against each other in a race to the bottom. And there's a bit in the afterword where I describe that bizarre episode with the Australian medicines industry where the Australian government said, oh, we're going to have an independent external review to look at whether we should tighten up the code of conduct on drug company marketing to doctors. And the Australian medicines industry, who represent about 2/3 of the drug companies in Australia, they said, oh, that's brilliant. Can you make sure that you get everyone to adhere to our very high standards of conduct? Because at the moment, it's quite difficult for us to get our members to do that because they're competing against people who are willing to be a little bit sneakier. But they're holding the line, and we've got high hopes for this review. The review came back and said, yep, let's have a high standard of conduct. And the Australian government, for reasons nobody really knows, said, no, actually, we're going to have a much lower standard of conduct. And the only person who criticised this, because the tragedy of all of this, of course, is, you know, the only people who basically ever criticise Big Pharma tend to be nutter conspiracy theorists or anti-vaxxer quacks or homeopaths who fantasise that somehow selling sugar pills is a meaningful response to grotesque regulatory failure on a global scale. The only people who put out a press release saying we criticise the Australian government for imposing low standards of conduct on the pharmaceutical industry was the AMI, the Australian medicines industry, the Australian pharmaceutical industry lobbyists. And they put out this press release that's almost heartbreaking, you know. It says, well, we're trying to hold our members to these high standards, but now you're making it impossible for us. So I think companies should campaign for higher standards. But lastly, I think people who work in the pharmaceutical industry ideally have to accept, and I hope it does happen, that it's no longer credible to pretend that all clinical trial data is published, because it just isn't. You know, we know from the latest study of whether the clinicaltrials.gov FDA Amendment Act has actually worked to make people publish their results within 1 year, and we know that only 1 in 5 of the trials that were supposed to have met that reporting obligation has actually posted its results on clinicaltrials.gov. Only 1 in 5. So anybody from industry who says this has been fixed because of clinicaltrials.gov and the FDA Amendment Act is being dishonest. I refuse to believe that they don't know about that result. I think they're being dishonest, and I think that is unethical. I think people from the pharmaceutical industry have got to be realistic about the fact that this is a serious, ongoing problem, and I hope that the public will hold them to account. I hope that the day will come when a representative of the pharmaceutical industry simply couldn't get away with standing up and claiming that all clinical trials research is published, because it would be as stupid and obviously wrong as claiming that World War II started in 1993. And, you know, I will do everything I can to make sure that they stop making these frankly ludicrous claims. And I think lastly, they have to recognise that it's not enough to fix it going from now onwards. Because there is this idea that if we fix the problem of missing trial data today, that somehow helps patients. But it doesn't. You know, anybody who's listening to this who takes any medicines, take those medicines out of your purse. Have a look at the name, look it up, see what date it came on the market. We're not using drugs that came on the market in 2012 or drugs that came on the market in 2008. Patients today are treated with drugs that came on the market in 2006, 2002, 1998, 1992, from this era when we know that the medical evidence was hopelessly distorted, hopelessly biased by clinical trial results that were deliberately and cynically withheld from doctors and patients. And that is the information that we need. You don't fix this by publishing only the clinical trial results of trials that finished from October 2008 onwards or October 2012 onwards. We need to go to those dry storage archives in the hills of Cheshire, I'm told, and we need to pull out those old forgotten discs on their old forgotten formats, and we need to get that data into the hands of doctors and patients and academics who can summarise it, extract meaning, and find out what works best.
What's next for you? What are you up to now, given that you've done science, you've done pharmaceuticals? What is it, economics next? Is it politicians?
I don't know. Well, I'm very interested in evidence-based policy, actually. So I don't know if you saw, but we did a cabinet office paper, me and another academic and a couple of civil servants, called Test, Learn, Adapt, which you can find on the cabinet office website or badscience.net. And that's looking at ways of doing more randomised controlled trials in government, wherever they are practical and ethical, and building capacity to get more of that done, and you know, just educating people to work around the spurious ethical objections that people make to using this extremely valuable tool.
So the idea of what, testing different policies out, you know, in a randomised control fashion?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be big dramatic things. I mean, everybody knows, of course, that it's going to be a little bit difficult to convince a government minister to do a randomised trial on his cherished policy, or her rarely cherished policy, to see if their intervention achieves its stated goals. But actually, you know, the business of government isn't just these big headline things. It's trivial everyday stuff. So there's one trial which we discuss in the paper, which looked at comparing different types of reminder letter to get people to send in their tax forms on time. And it found that one particular form of letter got more people to send their letter in on time than another form of reminder. And that saves money. It costs nothing. Doing the trial costs nothing, because you gather the follow-up data from routinely collected administrative records at HMRC in exactly the same way that our statins trial routinely collected electronic health record data from people's GP computers. There's another trial which I think really illustrates the danger of people raising ethical objections to doing policy trials. Because, so as I'm sure you're aware, people will often say, oh, it's not fair to randomly assign people to one policy or another because it's unfair, you'll be depriving them of something effective. So there's an extraordinary trial that looks at whether giving a £5 incentive payment increases the number of adult education classes that people attend. Now, getting trials like this going is really difficult because lots of people come along out of the woodwork and they say, well, that's really unfair. You're depriving half of the people in this study of £5 and maybe £120 over the course of a course. That's unethical. And of course, this £5 is going to improve attendance. So you're also depriving them of an education. And this is dreadful. You're unethical. You're doing the wrong thing. But actually, when this trial was conducted and completed, the results came in. It turned out that this £5 incentive payment actually reduced the number of adult education classes that people attended. Now, that's a remarkable finding, and you could talk from now to the end of the day about why it happened. But actually, I'm not sure I care about why it happened, because I care about methods and I care about implementation. And we know now that this £5 payment, in the context in which it was tested, does harm, it inflicts harm on people. And we wouldn't have known that if we hadn't done a randomised controlled trial. So people, I think, are very, very naive about the fact that in medicine and in policy and in many areas of everyday life, it is possible for people to inflict tremendous harm on other people, even with the best of intentions. So I think randomised trials in government, and also actually a really interesting area is randomised trials in business. Because I'm struck that all of the battles that we had in medicine 30 or 40 years ago are now being played out in policy and business. And people imagine that evidence-based medicine is a force of nature. But actually it's not. You know, people had to be convinced. Doctors thought that evidence-based medicine and epidemiology was all about young, numerate upstarts trying to bully them with statistics. And, you know, it took half a generation, maybe one generation, to shift that. And I think maybe we'll see that in policy and business too.
Ben Goldacre, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Ben Goldacre there. For more information about his new book, check out Ben's website. That's badscience.net. That's all we have for you this week. But for breaking science news night and day, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. So from Alec Jha and me, the producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.